Welcome to Above Alley Christian Church Podcast. You are listening to Steve McMillan share his message titled, Faith in the Seasons of Life, from the series titled, These Three Remain. This message was broadcasted live May 21st, 2023.
It's good to be with you this morning, and I'm really glad that I'm here and that you chose to be here. We are in the year of 2023, looking at these three great concepts of faith and hope and love, the three things that we hope as a church we can unleash into the world. And today, as we move from the first topic to the second, next week we'll move on to the topic of hope for a few weeks. I thought to myself, how do we sum up where we've been so far on the topic of faith? If you haven't been here for the last several months, we basically worked verse by verse through an entire chapter of Hebrews, chapter 11. And then the last three or four weeks, we've looked at various topics and how faith interacts with doubt, with failure, with family, with marriage, and all sorts of things. And I just thought that as we kind of sum up that, what would be the thing that that I would think is important for us to share? And I want to talk this morning about something that I haven't really ever talked about before. Now, this last week, there was a church that they wanted me to come speak. I said, what do you want me to speak about? And they said, something you've never spoke about before. I said, well, that sounds like a lot of work. But I've never talked about this before. Stages of life and faith. And so I want to do something a little bit different, kind of put on my, I should have worn my cardigan or my bow tie, because I want to actually kind of be a little bit in teacher mode this morning rather than preacher mode, and sort of just sum up some concepts and look at some ideas throughout history and ask this question that I wish that someone had asked for me years ago, but it's a question I'm pondering a lot these days, and that is, what is the landscape of our lifelong journey of faith? Our mission as a church is to find and follow Jesus, and what does that look like over the course of the decades? What does it look like when we're young? What does it look like when we're in the last seasons of life? And I'm interested in a topic that some people call spiritual cartography, which is kind of a pretentious way, basically, to sort of map the spiritual journey over the arc of a life. It's a Christian analog to what psychologists call stage theory. And I think it's really helpful for us to think this through, to sort of look at a map of what Christianity and following Jesus looks like through our entire life, and just sort of see where we are. And thankfully, Scripture is fairly implicit on this. History is explicit. And throughout history, there have been these maps that people have sort of put together and said, saints and sages, and they've sort of taken their hard-earned wisdom and they've kind of drawn a map to say, this is kind of what it's like following Jesus throughout an entire life. And the idea as I go through this is not that you would compare yourself or that you would contrast yourself or that you would feel up or down. It's just that maybe you could find yourself in this journey somewhere, because there are different, and this is why I'm doing this morning, there are different challenges and different invitations of Jesus at different stages of maturity in life. And I think we need to know that, or to put it another way, the message of the cross interacts with us, becomes real for us in different ways depending on where we are at in life. And so I just want to explore that. Really, I just want to open the door. The goal for this message this morning is simply that you would it would continue a conversation. This really should be a long class that I should develop, and maybe if anyone's interested, we'll do that some point in the future. But I just want to open the door to this and invite you to consider that faith looks different and what are the challenges and the invitations throughout it. Let me start with this little story. In his autobiography, he's a renowned writer. His name is Nikos, people say it different ways, Kazantzakis. And he shares a conversation that he has. He's sort of a spiritual author and sage, I guess you would say. And he had a conversation once with an old monk named Macarius. And Macarius was, he was sitting there with this saintly man, and Nicholas asked him, he said, "Do you still wrestle with the devil, Father?" And the old monk just sort of sat there for a while, and then he reflected, and he replied, "Not any longer, my child." He said, "I've grown old now, and he has grown old with me. He doesn't have the strength. I wrestle with God." "With God," exclaimed the young writer. He says, and you hope to win?" And the old monk said, "I hope to lose, my child. But my bones remain with me still, and they continue to resist." And the lesson is that we struggle with different things, different forces, at various times in our lives. That we're always struggling as people of faith with different kinds of things. And those forces kind of call us to change over the years. And so today I just want to lay out for you one particular summary of stages of faith and life, of which there are many, and I wish that I could share many of them with you. Several of the books that have influenced me, or authors that have influenced me, David Brooks wrote a great book called The Second Mountain. Richard Rohr and James Fowler and many others have written on the intersection between psychological development and faith development. But today I want to actually give you an outline that I first read, I think, 25 years ago by a guy named Ronald Rollheiser. He's a Canadian priest, and I like the way that he suggests that the stages of life and faith come together. He puts it in this way, of course, 3 points. He says there's essential faith, which is the struggle to get our lives together. There is maturing faith, which is the struggle to give our lives away. And then there is radical faith, which is the struggle to give our deaths away. And of course, with any of these things, these are broad generalities. You don't necessarily fit. One size does not fit all. And I don't dare give numbers or ages or when these things happen. But I think generally speaking, that these movements are very helpful for us to think about. So let's walk through these 3 together, and hopefully you can find yourself and maybe hear God's invitation to what's next in your journey of faith. So the first, the struggle to get our lives together. this, of course, begins early in life. From your first breath that you ever took onward, we begin to struggle with our own identity. From the time we were very small, we're struggling to discover who we are, discovering to find fulfillment, discovering to find peace, to sort of figure out who we are as opposed to other people. Now, this is why small kids, their favorite words are, in order, mine and no. They're trying to discover this right from the time we are small. But the struggle really takes poignancy when puberty comes along, or adolescence. Because prior to puberty, usually in the general home, and this is a generality, of course, unless your home is filled with trauma or great neglect, generally our lives are essentially together. We come home from the hospital, and there's a place that's ours. And there's a period of life called childhood that is kind of intended by God to be a secure place. It's safe. It's our home. And basically, when you're small, your great spiritual struggles, anthropological struggles too, have not yet begun. But that changes dramatically at puberty. Simply put, puberty or adolescence is designed by God to drive us by nature out of that home. And sometimes it does that too well, to be honest. I don't know. Some of you are in the midst of this, and some of you, this is a faint memory, and some of this is a memory you wish you could forget. But when it comes, it almost hits us with this almost violent amount of changes to us. And lots of those are hormones, and lots of those sexuality things. There's these grandiose ideas we have of life. It's also a time of great confusion, and we're searching for not to find the home that we have, but for the home that we will one day have. It's a longing for the next home. And the challenges of this stage are many. There's a lot of longing. There's a lot of searching for identity. There's searching for acceptance. There's trying to find a circle of friends. There's trying to find a special friend. There's the search for someone to marry. There's search for vocation, search for career, search for the right place to live, search for financial security, search for something of substance, the meaning and significance. We're searching for a home. There's all of these things, and if you look at any, even today, all throughout history, the music, the media, primarily designed for people in sort of this stage trying to get their life together is primarily about questions of identity and questions of sexuality and questions of meaning and questions of heartache and security and searching and longing for something. So there's many, many challenges. Struggling to get our lives together. In a sense, scripturally speaking, we would talk about this as identifying with, I think, the prodigal son, where you've left home and the prodigal son is just trying everything. It's a time of searching and finding and all of this energy, which is beautiful energy, but it's this energy that's both sexual energy and it's an energy for life that causes people in this stage to just go out and try to find the life that they want, try to find the home that is theirs. And faith during this time is often, we would describe as almost transactional, I think. It's kind of a quid pro quo. It kind of relates to God in the sense of, if I do this, fill in the blank, then God will do this, fill in the blank. If I put my faith in Jesus, then I will get to the right place when I die. If I tithe, then God will bless me financially. If I honor God with my sexuality, he'll give me a fantastic spouse. But at some point, faith during the struggle to get our lives together, if it's transactional, will basically fail you. The crisis will come and God will not give you what you thought he would give you, or you will do the right thing and you will not be rewarded, you'll be punished. And you will do what you thought was supposed to happen, but God doesn't come through. Or you will go through pain and you will go through suffering and you don't know where God is and you don't know what God is up to. I'm not trying to be the bearer of bad news, but it's only a matter of time if you haven't got there yet. And what you do with your faith as you try to get your life together is pretty crucial. For one thing, a lot of people just kind of give up on it. It didn't work out the way that I thought. God didn't come through the way I thought. This person still got sick. I didn't get this girlfriend or this boyfriend, or I didn't get this situation, or I made these mistakes and now I have all of these consequences. God didn't come through. And lots of people would just kind of, okay, then faith is not for me. It's too much. Or biblical speaking, you would fall away. Jesus said, when trouble or persecution comes, people who have a faith like that will quickly fall away. Or maybe, and I think this is maybe more common for Christian people, instead of falling away from your faith, you kind of compartmentalize your faith. And you just sort of put your faith over here. Maybe it's a Sunday kind of thing, but you put your career over here and your job over here and your family over here. And you kind of have this dissonance that drains you of any spiritual vitality. And this is where things like nominal Christianity would come. So if you are in this stage of life, what are the invitations? I want to suggest a couple. One is that this is an incredibly crucial time. And if you are, if you're a teenager here this morning, if you're a young adult here this morning, I want you to really think about this. Developing the secret place in your life. You say, what does that mean? Well, a guy by the name of Abraham Kuyper put this together. He said, our souls are like the temple. Our souls have an outer court. Our bodies, our identity as an outer court where basically it's you and everybody else. It's how you appear to everyone else. And you can look very good in the outer court. He says, but there's an inner court to the temple, and the inner court to the temple of who you are is something that only you and your closest people to you see. And so the people close to you might see something very different than what is seen in the outer court. Because for instance, right now, this is an outer court moment. But then Abraham Kuyper says there's a holy of holies in every person. It's the secret place. It's the place where only you and God know what is going on. It's where you commune with God, where you pray, where you speak to him, where you hear from him, and where you receive from him. Do you know that place? Jesus talked about this lots. When you pray, go to your closet, go to your secret place. Jesus was constantly doing this. Where is the guy? He's off in his secret place somewhere. Go there. Go there. If you're at this stage, you're trying to pull your life together, you need to have that relational space with God, the secret place. And when you get there, then you can receive. That's the place you receive. That's where you receive identity from God. What does the cross mean at this stage in our faith development? To me, it means the gift of identity, the gift of forgiveness. It means the gift of meaning. And so the message of the cross is good news for someone at this stage, because in their secret place, we go there and we receive the forgiveness that only God can give. We receive the identity that we are children of God and He's our good, good Father. We receive meaning. We receive guidance for life. And so if you're in this stage of life, I just want to invite you. The good news of the gospel is that there is a deeper place inside of you that other people cannot connect with in the way that God can. And so dwell in the secret place. And then secondly, I would encourage this. Invest in Jesus' community. When you're trying to get your life together, particularly, the people that you surround yourself with will determine so much of how your faith is able to be formed and able to be sustained. And I can't say this enough, that just about every person that I know of who has lost their faith has first of all lost their community of faith. So friends, if you are this morning, you're a teenager, or you're a person that's getting your life together, you feel like you're in university, consider this. Consider the secret place. Don't take it for granted. Spend time there. Listen to God's word, what God's word has to say. Spend time in prayer and spend time in community. I think those are tremendous invitations of good news. Well, of course, we don't stay there. Life continues on. And life continues on to what Rollheiser calls mature discipleship, or maturity in following Jesus in faith. But how do you get to a place of maturity? I like the way that one author puts this way. The move from struggling to get our lives together to struggling to give our lives away, he says, you need to learn these truths. And this is the transition phase. Here they are. Life is hard. You're going to die. You're not that important. You're not in control. Your life is not about you. Lots of laughter, not very many amens, but I hear you. These are the painful lessons that we learn, right? But you need to learn. And you can sort of tell when we forget these things. But when you move towards maturity, when you move past this phase of just getting your life together, something takes place. Yes, you acknowledge hard truths like this, but you also move into another phase where the question isn't just, how do I get my life together, but how do I live my life meaningfully? How do I give my life away? And again, I don't know the ages, but most people, I think, probably reach this kind of stage, Rollheiser says, somewhere in their 20s or 30s, although 40, 50, 60 could be. And the crossover between these phases is never pure, never complete. We still struggle for self-fulfillment. We still struggle with private fulfillment and self-identity. That doesn't ever go away. But somehow there's a shift from the restlessness and energy of youth. At a certain point, the default line changes. And for most of us, this is where we spend most of our lives in faith, in the faith journey. And for most of us, this is our adult years. We're wrestling with these kinds of questions. And there's lots of things that happen during this phase of life. We wrestle with things like busyness and finances and workaholism. Oftentimes, this is a time of disillusionment and grief, because by the time you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, something has happened. People have passed away. There's midlife crisis where things that you expected, things that you thought would be a certain way, are not. And so there's grief involved with that. There's financial pressures. There's just plain boredom with life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So many, many challenges. And faith during this time comes in lots of ways, but one of the words that I think marks this season of faith for a lot of us is the word crisis and disillusionment. In other words, we come to a point in our faith where it doesn't work out the way that we thought, and what will we do? Now, Barbara Brown Taylor, who's a great author and preacher, she says disillusionment is one of God's greatest gifts. So something happens, and you thought that God was a certain way, but then life happened, something took place, and it just, I think of it as a balloon, it popped your disillusionment, and God's not who you thought. And she says, the great journey of faith is, okay, God's not that. And she says, the great journey and the great step of faith is, okay, then who is he? What is he like? Maybe he's not a genie. Maybe he's not, who is he now? And so faith at this stage includes a lot of that, but it also includes, and this is where I think we identify not so much with the younger brother, but the older brother in the prodigal son story. It's because on the surface, remember the older brother? He was there the whole time, and yet when the younger brother came home, the older brother was kind of like judgmental, and he was on the farm the entire time, but his heart was far from the father. And the father welcomed the younger son home. But remember, the father also welcomed the older son in. But what was the older son doing out there? He was bitter. He was unforgiving. His heart, this is a great truth at this stage in life, his heart, his unforgiving heart, and his anger was just as much a blockage to entering into the father's joy as was any moral transgression of the younger son. And so there's certain challenges and invitations at this stage in life that that I'm working through. Maybe I'll put it that way. And here's, I think, the invitations for me and you. One is that at this stage in life, it's not just what you do, it's why you do it. It's moving from anger that life didn't work out, that people disappointed and hurt you, to a place of gratitude. It's moving from bitterness to forgiveness. It's moving from sort of a wounded ego, refusing to allow people to love you, to actually letting yourself be loved. It's this stage of faith has to do with inner heart surgery. It's replacing anger with forgiveness and guilt with confession, and greed with generosity. It's doing some cleaning of the heart. That's the invitation of spiritual surgery and the cross at this point. There's one of them. The second one that I think, and this is take a little bit of explaining, but the second one is this, that at this point, I think the message of the cross becomes super powerful in that what did Jesus do when he was on the cross? He was, when things happened to him, somebody put it this way, Jesus at the cross was like a water filter. You know, and if you've ever been to like a swamp, or you've been to like a place where the water is filthy and you have a water filter, you pour the swampy, murky, ugly water into the top, and then out of the bottom comes this pure water that you can drink. It's absolutely amazing. And they suggested, well, how did Jesus on the cross, what did he do? In essence, kind of what he did, stick with me here, this is a theological concept, but he took the hate, he took the violence, he took the anger, he took the rage, he took the false accusations, he took it into himself, and he offered back, not the same stuff. He transformed it and then offered back forgiveness and hope and love. In other words, He takes in the sin of the world, and it's not like magic. There's lots of mystery here, but it's not magic. He absorbs the sin of the world, and he transforms it, and he gives back love. So he takes in the bitterness of these people killing him, and he transforms it. He takes in the curses that people are giving to him. He holds it, and he transforms it into blessing. He takes murder into himself. And he returns with, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. He doesn't give curse for curse or jealousy for jealousy. Instead, he retransmits. He transforms and then gives them something different back. And one of the ways that we give our lives away is that we do the same thing. That at this stage of faith, energies that come to us in life, we don't just turn around and send them back into the world. We transform them into something different. Sounds a little abstract. Let me put it another way. We refuse to give in kind. So if someone comes to you with negativity, you absorb that negativity. And rather than just taking the negativity and throwing negativity back to them and the rest of the world, you absorb it, you take it in, and instead of mindlessly transmitting it, you instead take it in and transform it and offer faith and hope and love back. In this way, there's a sense in which we too take the sins of the world and take them away. Again, not easy to do. When someone comes to you and they're yelling and they're screaming and they're angry, what kind of energies do you respond with? Right? But isn't it beautiful when somebody is able to receive negative or darkness or anger or whatever false accusation, absorb it and not return it? It's beautiful. It's actually a lot like grace, isn't it? Now, that doesn't mean that we just are doormats and there are places we need to process things, and I recognize water filters, there's a lot of gunk that still needs to be taken care of. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there's a level of maturity that doesn't give back in kind. It gives back in kindness. And then the last one, how do we give our lives away? I'll suggest this. Is that there's a stage in the maturity and the development of a disciple where they become intentionally a blesser. Let me hang out here just for a minute. It would seem to me, and I can't remember which author I originally started thinking about this with, but that our society, let's start there, is bleeding from a lack of blessing. And when you're not blessed in life, it's like your heart gets tied up in knots. It gets constricted. It makes your heart hard to get at. And so you can try to free your heart, but if you're never blessed, then it's just this tangle of things. And if your heart is wrapped up and tied up, you'll try to do all kinds of things to get it untangled. You'll try to get it open. And so you'll try all kinds of things. You might try therapy, you might try sexuality, you might try achievement or intellectual or artistic pursuits or something to try to free yourself. You'll go after things really, really hard, but it doesn't succeed for very long. And it would seem to me that your heart, my heart, doesn't get set free by our brains, and it doesn't get set free by sexuality, and it doesn't get free by your hands. It gets set free through blessing. Blessing deconstructs our hearts. And what does it mean to bless somebody? Well, to bless somebody is to, first of all, to see them. The Queen passed away, thought of this year, years ago. The Queen came to where we were living. Rebecca went to see the Queen. And her words to me afterwards, I said, how was it? She said, she looked right at me. She saw me. Well, that's what good queens do, right? They genuinely look at somebody and they acknowledge that they're there. They see them. This is why it feels so bad when you feel like nobody saw you. Because that's the opposite of being blessed. So you see them. And then the second thing that blessing, I think, curtails is that you actually take delight in them. This is the great blessing of Jesus when he was baptized, or Jesus, the words from heaven, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. I take delight in you. I remember talking to a teenager one time, trying to encourage them, trying to say that I took delight in them, trying to tell them that I thought they were a special and remarkable young man and a person with incredible potential, incredible gifts, and I needed him in my life and all these things. And it just looked like he didn't believe me at all. And as I tried to say to him, like, do you hear what I'm saying? And he's like, that sounds too good to believe. He hadn't been blessed. So to bless somebody is to see them and to take delight in them. And this is, then there's a third part in this that I think is so crucial for us in this phase of life, and that is that blessing means that we give our lives for them. This is why blessing often works from the top down, or from God to us, from old to young, from empowered to disempowered, from those who have a full life to those who don't. Because to bless somebody is to give a part of my life to another person. So it's not just an affirmation, hey, you're good, you're awesome, you're a fine young man, you're a gifted young woman, I believe in you. It's more than that. It's to, in some real way, die for another person so that they can live. Good parents know this. Mothers and fathers do this for their children. We do this in all kinds of ways. We give up what? Everything? Sleep, time, energy, money. I'll stop there. Why? We die to ourselves, the things that we want to do with those things, so that they can live. We don't do it begrudgingly most of the time. Most of the time it's a great honor, right? You're like, oh, this is amazing to do this. Now, this is what good teachers do for their students, and good pastors, and good doctors, and good nurses, and good politicians. This is what older people do for younger people. When I was 21 years old, I became a senior pastor. Well, that's a ridiculous thing to have happen. And there was a person in the church, his name is David Ledbury, and he was the authority in the church. He was one of the elders, and he was a person that made the decisions in the church. He decided everything, and nothing got decided without him. When I came to the church, he spoke blessing to me. He said, I believe in you. I believe in the pastor that you can be. I believe in the preacher that you can be. I said, that was fantastic. It felt good because I didn't really believe in myself. But then he did something else. Then he let me make decisions. And then I heard later that he would say to people, they would come to him and say, you know, you got this 21-year-old lead senior pastor, and he said this and this, and I don't think that's right. And he made these decisions. And David would respond like this. Whatever Steve says, I'm behind him. What did he do? He gave up his authority, his power, his influence, so that I could live. It was beautiful. Changed my life. I say all of this to say, those of us who are older, and there's many of us in this room that are, the most powerful thing that we can do for those who are younger is to bless them. It's not to correct them. It's not to criticize them. It's not to bemoan the things that they are doing. It's to bless them. We have an entire generation who desperately needs blessing, and you have the ability to do it. If you've been a Christian for a while, I think you're called to do it as your next step of faith. I really believe it. You say, what does that mean? It could mean a whole bunch of things. It could mean affirmation. It could be seeing young people. It could be serving downstairs. It could be countless things. But it could also be that you need to give your job away, or you need to give your authority away, or you need to give your opportunities to others so that they can develop and take your place so that you can bless them with life. I think that's part of what it means to struggle to give our lives away. Lastly, and I'll do this far too quickly for what it deserves, the third stage would be what Rollheiser calls the struggle to give our death away. We don't talk about this much, but no matter what phase we're in, if you're here this morning, you're not yet dead, and so you still have a major spiritual task ahead of you, perhaps the most daunting of all. One of the guides on this that I think serves the Christian church maybe the best, or at least that I'm aware of, is Henry Nouwen. And he, as he came toward the end of his life, wrote a lot about this. And he makes these, I'll quote a few things from him. He says, at a certain point in our lives, the question is no longer, what can I still do so that my life makes a contribution, but how can I now live so that my death will be an optimal blessing to my family, the church, and the world? Great question. Or to put it another way, we must leave home a second time. And this time, the unknown is even larger. I think of this sometimes in terms of, again, the cross. How does this interact at this stage in our lives? Jesus both lived for us and died for us. He gave us both his life and his death. I don't know if you've thought about that. But in essence, he gave us his life through his activity, through his generous actions and teachings for us. But he gave us his death through his passivity. If you read the Gospels and you read, it's so much, this happened to him, this happened to him, this happened to him. His death was for us in that it was passive. He absorbed in love these things like helplessness and humiliation and the ultimate loneliness of dying. And I think in some way we're meant to give our lives away in activity, generosity, selflessness. Yes. But I wonder, and this is more of a discussion point than, you know, a firm conviction, but I wonder if we're also meant to give our deaths away. And not just like the moment that you die, but the whole process of leaving this earth in such a way that our diminishment or our death is our final and perhaps our greatest gift to the rest of the world. This is not easy. I've thought about this a lot over the years as I've hung around deathbeds. I think Henry Nouwen gives us some more wisdom here. He says, our lives belong not just to us, but also to others. This applies to our deaths as well. If we die with guilt, shame, anger, or bitterness, all that becomes part of our legacy to the world, binding and burdening the lives of our family and friends. It is possible, on the other hand, to regard our dying as a gift, an opportunity to pass along to others our own sense of peace with God. And then this, he says, the central question is not how much time remains, but rather how can we prepare so that our dying will be a new way for us to send our spirit and God's spirit to those whom we have loved and who have loved us. There is, he says, such a thing as a good death. We are responsible for the way we die if we are able. We have to choose between clinging to life in such a way that death becomes nothing but a failure or letting go of life in freedom, so that we can be given to others as a source of hope. This is not easy, particularly, of course, because we spend most of our lives in activity. We spend most of our lives trying to build this home that puberty drove us out of. I remember actually, a few examples of this, but one man in his 60s dying of cancer, and he had been an executive, a great dad, great father, led a company that was great, and he's in the hospital bed dying, and he can't provide for himself any of his basic needs. And I come in and he immediately grabs my hand, which is not something that he and I had ever done before. And he says, you have to help me. I'm dying. I've always been in charge. I took care of my family. I took care of my company. I took care of the church. I took care of things. And now I can't even take care of myself. Nurses have to bring me a bedpan. I can't go to the bathroom. Dying is one thing, but this is another. I'm helpless. I can't do this anymore. In a sense, he was experiencing what Jesus experienced. Passivity is the word that some people use. It's actually the word passion lends to passivity. They're connected. So just like Jesus, this friend had been in charge. He'd been active. He'd been busy. But then now, like Jesus, in the moments before his death, he had been reduced to being a patient. He'd been reduced to one that was ministered to by other people. Well, what do you say? Well, what I would say now is to try to help him understand the connection between what he was going through and what Jesus went through. Helplessness. Dependence. Humiliation. that there's a sense, and this is kind of holy ground, so like our death and dying can be our greatest gift to others. But I think we're in danger of losing this. In a world that identifies value with like utility or your ability to do things, identifies, health and pragmatism are like the greatest value. What do we do with those of us who are at a stage in life where we can't actively contribute? What's the value of someone who lives with Alzheimer's or somebody who is in palliative care? Or somebody who can't mentally acknowledge us or can't contribute? And I wonder if the mystery, and this is back to the cross as we've done with each of these three stages, is the mystery of this idea of passivity, which is basically a helplessness, that there's something that we can give that's deeper than what we can even give in strength and activity. Jesus died, of course, by crucifixion, which was a horrible physical amount of suffering. The Romans designed it that way, but they didn't just design it to be physically horrible. They designed it to be mentally, emotionally, and publicly a place of humiliation for the person being executed. To be a little graphic, the person was stripped naked, hung on a cross, genitals exposed. And often at the moment of death, or just before, the bowels would loosen in further humiliation. It was not a pretty sight. But neither is death through aging or cancer or dementia or any others. And just like crucifixion, terminal illness inflicts pain and humiliation. And there's a sense that that's the place where we're asked to identify with Jesus and give our deaths away. Well, what does this stage of faith look like? I'll just suggest this one word. It's a place of surrender, where you don't just believe in God, you believe God. You aren't just believing God for a particular outcome, but just for him. Robert Mulholland, I like his way he describes this. He says it's a deep inner posture of joyful release of our life and being to God in absolute trust, without demands, without conditions, without reservations. It's neither a passive resignation nor a fatalistic acquiescence to whatever comes. It is rather a consistent posture of actively turning our whole being to God so that God's presence, purpose, and power can be released through our lives into all situations. And I would have to say I'm not anywhere close to that. I'm like driving to Regina and the sign says, 800 kilometers away, but I'm moving in that direction, I hope. Maybe the best summation of this is from an old saint, St. Teresa of Avila's prayer. This was her prayer. She put it this way: let nothing disturb you. Let nothing make you afraid. All things pass, but God is unchanging. Patience is enough for everything. You who have God lack nothing. God alone is sufficient. And this is called her bookmark prayer because when she died, they found it in her handwriting, in her Bible. And she would just come back to this day after day, just this ability to hold the reality of our lives right in front of us. No denial, no escapism, right there. And to be grateful and to be content and to be at peace with God. This is Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane at the pinnacle of spiritual maturity, where he says, right after, let this cup pass from me, he says, Father, your will be done, not mine. This is Job at the end of his story when he says, my eyes have seen the Lord. Now I repent in dust and ashes. And Job goes silent. He's quiet. No more questions, no more demands of God. Just, you're God and I'm not. It's kind of the highest level of faith. It's not a faith where you think things are going to work out great. It's the faith that no matter what happens, and God forbid, even if the worst thing, our worst fears come true, that we don't have to be afraid, that we are not alone. That God may not take away all of our pain and suffering, but we do not need to be afraid because he is with us and he will make things beautiful in his own time. So, just some light thoughts on long weekend in May. Let me ask you this question. Where do you think you're at? And I know these are kind of, they blur together and different stages. I just think it's super helpful for us to see the possibilities of where we are going. And I guess my second question would be, where's the gospel invitation for you right now? Is it that you need to come to the cross and you need to hear a reminder of your identity, that you need to hear a reminder of your significance and meaning? Or do you come to the cross today and the good news for you, where you're at, is that because you have those things, because God has blessed you in the secret place and in your faith community, now maybe the invitation is that you can do things that were never possible before. You can bring light into a dark world by absorbing and not returning. That you can bring light into a dark world and give your life away by actually blessing others into life, just like Jesus in his death gave us life. Where are you at today? And I know for some of you, the concept of giving your death away is a pretty poignant one, because you know it's imminent and it's not that far away. And maybe the invitation of the gospel is one you hadn't thought of before, that maybe you identify even with Jesus in his passivity, in his last moments. The good news is that we travel this road as a church family together. And we're all on different stages. And my encouragement to you is that we need each other for all of this. And we need to come back to the cross.